After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon. For the following episode, please be advised that the conversation includes mention of gun violence and suicide.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm joined today by pastor, author, and theologian Nadia Boltz-Weber. Nadia is an ordained Lutheran pastor and the founder of the House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver, Colorado. She's the creator and host of the Confessional Podcast, which invites guests to share stories about times that they were at their worst, and is executive produced by our friends over at The Moth. Nadia is the author of 3 New York Times bestselling memoirs, Pastrix, which was re-released in May of 2021, Accidental Saints, and her 2019 release, Shameless, A Sexual Reformation. In 2021, she launched The Chapel, a year-long project that serves as a pop-up chapel for in-depth conversation, daily prayer, and community. Nadia is considered a leader in the emerging church movement, redefining the church and how the tradition is embodied today. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the Metta Hour, Nadia.
Oh my gosh, it's really fun to be here. It's fun because I've listened to you in my meditations. I'm sure people say that. And now you're like talking. I feel like you're talking directly to me when I listen to your meditations. And now you're actually, I think I like manifested, now she's actually talking to me.
Someday, who knows, maybe we'll be together in the same room. It's like, I know. There's a visual, you know, like, oh, great. Where are you beaming in from for this recording?
My closet.
Oh, you, that's the way to do it. I never did that. I had, yeah. I did an audio version of my most recent book, and everyone wanted me to empty out a closet. And I thought, you just haven't seen my closet. Yeah. You know, like,
yeah. I live in Denver, and I live in an apartment, so there's not a lot of space.
Wow, how great! Well, you sound great, so it's working.
Yeah, good. I'm glad.
And we have a really good mutual friend in common. That's Catherine Burns, who's the artistic director at The Moth. And that's how I first encountered your work. So thanks to Catherine for connecting us. And you have quite an extraordinary life story. You grew up in a fundamentalist Christian family. Your parents were part of the Church of Christ. But you left as a young adult and went on to eventually study religion on your own terms and become an ordained Lutheran pastor. And can you give us a flavor of what that journey was for you?
Well, it was unforeseen, I mm-hmm. think. I mean, it was not what I planned or expected of my life. It just kind of unfolded really as a call. And for, mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I didn't have this like pious, I just want to be a pastor and serve the church. I had like none of that. It was just, I happened to stumble into Lutheranism, and I really loved it as a theological system because it's really based in paradox and mystery, not like certainty and dualism. And so I was really drawn to it. And as somebody in recovery, it gave me language for what I'd already experienced to be true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, it wasn't like I adopted some external ideology as my own. I found one that was such a beautiful articulation of my own experience, especially as somebody who'd gotten sober. And so I had started going to church and I ended up really loving the liturgy and sacraments and these more ancient traditions. I loved that they seemed to kind of have their own integrity. They didn't demand my integrity in order to be efficacious. I got to just participate. And when I was in that period, a friend of mine named PJ, who was also, who went to the same AA meeting I did, we were all kind of trying to get sober, stumbling through life, doing stand-up comedy because none of us could afford therapy. So it just was like cheaper and you got $30. And PJ was just hilarious and also an alcoholic, but struggled with some additional mental health issues. And sadly, we watched him sort of his spirit and mind disintegrate a bit and we lost him to suicide. And when PJ died, all our friends just looked at me and they're like, well, you can do the funeral, right? And I'm like, what? And they're like, well, I literally was just the only religious person in my friend group. And so they just assumed I could do it. And I said, okay. And it was at the Comedy Works in downtown Denver. And it was just packed with like comics and academics and recovering alcoholics and queers. And I just looked out and I thought, these people don't have a pastor and they need a pastor. And then I was like, oh, shit. I think maybe that's me. I don't know. It was weird and sudden and like, uh-oh. And so I just felt kind of called to be a pastor to my people because people need pastors who aren't like actual just church people too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what you described as hearing the articulation of what you deeply knew from within is just about the most beautiful expression of insider wisdom. You know, that it's not like this foreign commodity that we're asked to now hold, you know, but it's just this affirmation of like, yeah, I knew that. Oh, I knew that, you know, or I didn't know the words for that.
That's right. And like just the simple thing of, I have it tattooed on my wrist in Latin, simul justus et peccator, which Martin Luther wrote, which is simultaneously sinner and saint. Like we're all 100% of both all the time. Mm-hmm. And when they said that, I was like, oh my gosh, that explains a lot.
Mm-hmm. I noticed too, in the name of the church, the house for all sinners and saints, that sinners come first.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, oh, my mind paused a moment, you know, before I read that.
But that's not like two distinct categories of people.
Yeah. That's us.
That's everyone. That's every person. Yeah.
It's also interesting to me because within the Buddhist world, some of, you know, for very classical or traditional Buddhists, especially Asian Buddhists, some of that feeling comes from a belief in rebirth, where in the course of many, many lifetimes, we've all done everything. Huh. You know, we've helped one another, we've saved one another, we've hurt one another.
Yeah.
And so within that cosmology, the single most illogical feeling to ever have is self-righteousness.
You know? It's eliminated. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about the Psalms. I think there's like almost every human experience expressed in the Psalms. And sometimes people get a little edgy. They're like, oh, it's so violent. And you're asking like God to smite your enemies. I'm like, you've never felt that? I've totally felt that, you know? I mean, I felt that on Thursday. Exactly. So one of the things I love about the Psalms is that it has this just incredible breadth of human experience and failing and bliss. It's all there.
Now, there's a very delicate dance, I would think, you know, certainly in my experience, between recognizing that and also recognizing that actions have consequences, you know, and that we have to the best of our ability, make different choices sometimes.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things I think I'm thinking about a lot right now as I'm writing a book about forgiveness right now, but like from the standpoint of an asshole, not an expert, just to be clear. But but thinking about how I think justice and forgiveness are two separate orders of reality, maybe. Like I don't know. It's something I'm struggling with right now.
Well, I'm sure we're going to get there in the course of this conversation because it's very important. So one of the things I was most curious to talk to you about was shame, because I'm writing a book too. And And one of the chapters seems to be about, as it's still emerging, you know, some of the things that society urges upon us as the most fulfilling or the most expansive or the most important are some of the things that hurt us the most, actually.
Like what?
Like shame, for example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, that would be the perfect example of, I mean, there's something that we need. And one psychologist was trying to help me draw a distinction between what he called toxic shame and conscience, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But in terms of that toxic shame, it's so urged upon us. And and yet, you know, the consequences are so terrible, and it's not onward leading.
Well, I think one of the consequences of shame that we don't really talk about is I think shame actually keeps us from being able to speak the truth about our failings. Mm-hmm. Like, it actually keeps us from the truth of the ways maybe we haven't done something we should, or we've done something we shouldn't have. You know, in my sort of mythic creation narrative in the Garden of Eden, I've always been curious what it would have been like if, when Adam and Eve, you know, ate the forbidden fruit and they were hiding from God. The interesting thing about that story to me is that, they covered themselves because they were ashamed of their nakedness, but that was only after they listened to a voice that was not a divine voice tell them who they are. Mm-hmm. It was the snake, you know? And so God's like, hey, where are you guys hanging out? And they're like, oh, we're scared of you and we're naked. And God's like, hold on, who told you you were naked? Mm. I'm like, my money's on the snake. Mm-hmm. But which to me says that, like, shame has an origin and it isn't in the divine. Shame often originates in voices that claim they are speaking for God and they're not, or voices that are claiming an authority that they don't truly have. And so I've always wondered how the story would have ended differently if Adam and Eve just said, oh, yeah, well, we did something you told us not to, and now we kind of get it, and, you know, are we good? And God's like, yeah, we're good, right? But they couldn't do that. They couldn't just tell the truth. They had to point, they had to blame other people, they had to lie, they had to hide, all of the things we do now as a result of shame. I mean, shame makes us place blame on everything externally. It makes us not admit the truth. So I think that if freedom comes from some kind of truth about ourselves, shame will always obscure it, both the good and the bad, both.
I know shame is also the topic of your most recent book, Shameless, A Sexual Reformation. And you describe the book as an overhaul of our harmful and antiquated ideas about sex, gender, and our bodies. So I'm curious about what spurred the book for you.
Like, really? You want me to?
Well, I don't know.
No, I will. I totally will. But, you know, hold on. So I was married to a truly good man, but it was a very difficult, lonely marriage that had really no kind of intimacy to it. We were roommates, co-parented, and we had a very friendly divorce without lawyers or anything, and we're very respectful and kind with each other now. But it was very lonely. And that part of me the erotic part of me was just sort of necessarily shut down for a long time. Mm-hmm. And when we got divorced and I got together with Eric, who was my boyfriend in 93, 94, and we're still together, deeply, passionately in love with each other. But when we first got together and we did have that erotic connection with each other, it felt like an exfoliation of my whole spirit. Honestly, mm-hmm. I was like, oh my gosh, this, everything felt softer. I just thought, this is good for mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. And, but a couple weeks after we got together, I had to go on tour to support the UK and the German edition of Accidental Saints. And so I was on the road for 3 weeks and I had all this stuff swirling in my mind. And I realized, even though I'm ordained in a very liberal denomination, I had to sign a document when I was ordained that said I would be faithful in marriage or celibate in singleness. Mm. And I was married at the time and I didn't even think about it. And suddenly I'm walking around London going, why the hell did the church make me sign a document saying I wouldn't do this mm-hmm. when this is clearly good? And I was like, how is it better for my congregation if I'm not getting laid? Like, that just made no sense to me. And so I text Eric and I was like, can you hop on Skype right now? And he said, well, it's 5 a.m, but okay. So I'm walking in London going, and he's a heathen, right? He's not Christian. And he's very faithful heathen. And I said, why do you think for so long that the church has tried to control sex? And without skipping a beat, he just said, oh, I always assumed that the church saw sex as its competition. Oh, and I was like, oh, I'm writing a book. Uh-huh. Like, literally, that uh-huh. was the moment. Because uh-huh. I knew he was right, yeah. and I wanted to figure out why he was right and how he was right.
That's really fantastic. Now, that is intricate, and I could spend a long time just thinking about that, but I'll go on for a moment.
Totally.
You know, because that relationship with honesty is also really important. I was talking to somebody about vulnerability the other day, and they asked me how I would define it. And I said, I have a kind of, I think, unusual definition of vulnerability. I talk about it as honesty, you know, because it's so much easier, for example, in a communication with somebody to be accusatory, like, you know, you're never there for me, or you're never there for anybody, or you're creepy or whatever. And it's much more difficult to say, I was hoping, I was yearning for some real connection. And when you blew me off or whatever, you know, that was hurtful to me. That is so vulnerable. And yet it's so truthful.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You know, Annie Lamott in her latest book. Do you know Annie?
I do.
Yeah, I do too. She's lovely. But in her latest book, she talks about how she has a friend who says that when you first meet him, you're really meeting his bodyguard.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And I'm like, oh, man. I had such a good bodyguard. Like, I'm so grateful to her. Like, she did a lot for me over the years, but she was pretty much off duty during COVID, you know, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I was just in my apartment. But like, being on the road and being somebody who does tell pretty honest stories about myself, mm-hmm. You know, in 2019, I was on 90 airplanes in 7 countries. Like, my bodyguard did a lot of work. And yet, having her off duty for a year and a half, when I started being around people more, I was like, I'm not the same person I was. None of us are the same mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. we were before this. And like, I think she might have just earned a lot of PTO. Mm-hmm. So she's just going to continue, hopefully, to be off duty.
So, you know, continuing on with, although as you say that, I think I was on that many planes too. It was really bad.
Yeah, I know. But how did it, Sharon, how did it feel when, like, because, you know, that was 2019 and then to 2020, I was in my apartment.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did that feel for you to have that change?
In so many ways, it felt really good, you know, and other ways it was very difficult. It was a big surprise, you know. I came back to Barre, Massachusetts, which is where I'm speaking to you from right now. Even though I had a rental apartment in New York City, I had been in California all of February of 2020 and then got back to New York. And then I just felt very kind of uneasy there. And I thought, I'll go up to Barre, where I have a home and a retreat center, which was still open at the time. And once again, it just opened the other day, reopened. But, wow. You know, I thought, I'll go up there for a couple of weeks and ride this out, you know, until it's done. So came up here with my snow boots and I was here for almost a year and a half.
Yeah.
You know, and I have, you know, the backgrounds of being on retreat and, you know, living in solitude, basically. You know, I had a very small group of people that I ever saw. And, you know, so there was a part of it that felt natural and there's a part of it that was incredibly difficult, mostly because I was on Zoom, you know, so many hours, and I felt really connected to people and yet couldn't totally be there with them. And just like reading those chats, you know, like it was, it was something. And being very connected to New York, which was so bad. And you know, it's been a lot. And now, of course, it is like the kind of the reemergence, which has its own oddity.
Yeah.
And although I have not been on an airplane and I don't even know when I would be again. But it's, you know, allowed me to work on this book in the first time ever without also traveling.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting. And, you know, I feel sort of more one-pointed than before. So, I did get really fascinated by this idea of shame and kind of the importance of conscience and that just that sensitivity, you know, to love oneself enough or have enough compassion for oneself to not want to drink or not tell lies, you know, and just not be in that way. Even if the lies, I tell a story in a previous book about somebody offered an apartment in New York City, which is a very complicated real estate story, very familiar to anyone who's ever rented an apartment in New York, where it was like an illegal sublet. And it was perfect in terms of location and rent and all that. But this person telling me the story said, I knew I could not walk into that lobby every day knowing I had a secret.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh my, you know, gosh. And so there's something about that is so supportive. And then there's something about what I'm calling shame, I guess what my friend would have called toxic shame, which is so debilitating, you know, and it's so devastating. And I find myself just really interested in trying to draw that distinction.
Well, I think, shame can be debilitating. I think it can also be incredibly motivating. Like it can be an engine that drives a lot of things we do. Like, because I have to either prove that voice right or I have to prove that voice wrong. And I'm like, if we could capture, I mean, shame as an energy source, it could replace fossil fuels. Like, I think really it's very powerful. And so we can spend so much energy in response to it one way or the other.
Another distinction that the psychologist friend was trying to make for me was, I mean, he used the words very differently than I would have used it them from the Buddhist psychology, where he said, shame is feeling, well, guilt is feeling that I've done something wrong, and shame is feeling I am wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a very particular use of the words. And, you know, in the Buddhist psychology, it's a little different. It would be more like regret or remorse is wholesome and helpful, you know, because as the Buddha said very beautifully, if you truly loved yourself, you'd never harm another. And so that recollection brings up that lack of love for ourselves and all the things we do. And guilt is considered more that obsessive being stuck. You know, I am bad and I am terrible and I did all these other things. So I'm also just trying to make my way through all the language.
Well, I've been thinking about, like, what does it mean to forgive ourselves? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's in my work on this book. That's what I'm trying to puzzle through, because I realize, like, if I think about the people in my life that I am not in a place of forgiveness toward, mm-hmm. Part of what that looks like is that I only see them as the thing they did that hurt me. Mm-hmm. Like it can feel very difficult to recall the beautiful parts of our friendship or the times when we were good to each other or the love or the laughter we had. Recalling those good things feels like a betrayal of the part of me that they hurt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I can only, to maintain that place of unforgiveness, I can only afford to see them as just the thing they did that hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if when it comes to forgiving ourselves, if it's a little bit the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
If I can't forgive myself for mistakes I've made or things I've done or said or not done or said, I'm only seeing myself as that.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot let competing information that might be positive about who I am enter. And it's almost like feeling bad is close enough to being good,
mm-hmm.
that, mm-hmm. you know, that we do that. Like we can't let go of the feeling bad because it's kind of close to being good.
That's really fascinating. I mean, I really bow to you for taking on the topic because it's a difficult, difficult word. And one of my friends, my colleague, Sylvia Boorstein, once said, forgiveness is not amnesia.
Yeah.
You know, which is the way most people take it. And I've also seen several times where somebody chooses love or chooses to move on, but they don't like calling it forgiveness. You know?
Interesting.
I taught once in Israel, and there was somebody in the retreat who clearly was in a lot of physical discomfort, kind of wiggling and moving all the time. And, seemed to be in a lot of pain. And then the friend I was teaching with gave a talk on forgiveness, which he did not like. So he went up to complain to me. And he said, I was in a terrorist attack and I have all this shrapnel in my body and I'm always in pain. And he said, I will never forgive. But what I've learned is essential is to learn to stop hating.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'd take that, you know?
Yeah, like, yeah, for sure.
It's pretty good. Sure. I remember in the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., walking, you know, through it. And the very last exhibit was like video testimony of people who'd been in the Holocaust, usually as children. And this one woman told her story, you know, and the loss of all her people. And she said, I've brought up my own children to love and not to hate, but I'll never forgive.
Hmm.
And that's the last thing you hear when you walk out the door. And I thought, wow, that's also pretty good to bring up your children to love and not to hate.
Yeah.
In that circumstance.
I feel like it's because if saying I forgive this comes perilously close to saying that what happened was okay.
Yeah.
And if we know with everything in our being it was not okay, then of course we won't do that. But I'm in all of it, no matter what my pursuit is spiritually, I'm in it for one thing, which is freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be free from my own bullshit. I want to be free from shame. I want to be free from lies. You know, I just want freedom. And so when I don't forgive someone, I am choosing to still be connected to them. I mean, it can feel like that I can absorb their toxic stuff through some kind of thing that is a chain between us. And so for me, forgiveness isn't saying what you did was okay. It's saying what you did is so not okay. I refuse to be connected to it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like bolt cutters saying, I'm choosing my freedom from your stuff. Because if I don't do it, it can enter and metastasize in me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a friend of mine, I think it's an AA saying, after a kind of obsessive bout of thinking about someone else's issues and the grievance and the behavior, said, I let him live rent-free in my brain for too long.
Yeah, totally. I know. Jeez. No kidding. And at the same time, I think it is important to do our own work. Sometimes my insistence that the other person is 100% at fault and my unwillingness to let that go and the passion I have about that and the story I tell about that is very much fueled by the fact that actually 90% was them and 10% was me. And it's mm-hmm. the shame about my 10% that actually drives the passion about insisting they were 100% at fault. And, you know, we don't want to like blame the victim and stuff, but there's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that's just one of the worst things I've ever read. It says, if we look back far enough, we will find that at some point in the past, we made a decision based on self that put us in a position to be harmed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you will never be an Instagram influencer with those kind of messages, man. Never.
I was just about to give a plug for AA in that regard. I read the Big Book a million years ago. I can't remember what was in it, but I did notice that in different organizations that I've been involved in, when there's been a lot of conflict and difficulty and struggle in some way, that the people I've admired the most have been the people who are in some 12-step program.
Yeah.
Because they seem to find this interesting place of taking responsibility for what might be their part in the dynamic without like being crushed by guilt or shame, you know, like it's all my fault. And
that's
it's,
right.
you know,
that's
and
right.
I thought, look at that. That is a talent, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's an extraordinary. I mean, when I was in my parish and people wanted to meet me for pastoral care, a lot of times they were telling me a very rehearsed story.
Mm-hmm.
And I would listen and I would try and listen deeply, but only for a certain amount of time. And then I would say, like, I'm so sorry. I can hear the hurt that this caused and all of this. And I have good news and bad news. The good news is, like, you can, I really believe you can be free from what you're feeling right now. The bad news is that you're going to have to look at what your part was in it. Like, because telling a well-rehearsed story about somebody else's blame and fault, I'm like, look, it feels good for a minute, but, like, only in the way that peeing your pants feels warm for a minute, you know, like it's not a lasting thing. Right. So, I understand the sort of the little brain chemistry hit you get off of that, but it will never make you free because mm-hmm. you're going to have, even if only 10% is your fault or your part, until you deal with that, you will have no freedom. There's no freedom to be found for any of us in dwelling in what other people have done wrong.
Mm-hmm.
None. It might feel good. It might be good for clarity. It might be good for recognizing a pattern that we're drawn to people who behave a certain way that hurts us. That's useful. But freedom, it doesn't come from that.
Well, the other place that you tackle shame, and I assume forgiveness, is on your podcast, The Confessional. which you describe as a car wash for people's shame and secrets. So what are you learning there?
I'm learning it's nearly impossible to book guests for it. that's why I haven't done a fourth season. And the reason is, like, people have very well-rehearsed stories about being victims of other people's misbehavior. Mm-hmm. And, like, I it was so hard to book that I even went on my Twitter, like a cattle call, like, are you a fan of The Confessional? Do you have a confession? You think you'd be a good guest? You know, email my producer. And we got 30 self-pitying emails. Mm. Like, not one where people in any way could sort of talk about their own complicity in something, or that they did something that hurt others. And I was kind of looking, I was just taking a wide view of how often that was happening. And I thought, the math is not working here. If we only have people who have stories about how other people have harmed them, and nobody has stories about how they've harmed other people. Mathematically, I'm like, who are the three people hurting all of the millions, you know? And again, I think shame keeps us from admitting this stuff, you know? It's kind of like, I don't know, like I'm pretty confident in my own intellect. And because of that, like, if someone uses a word I don't know, I just stop them immediately. And I'm like, what's that word mean? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know why? I'm not insecure about my intellect. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something similar. It's only people who are slightly insecure about their intellect that pretend to know words they don't know. And I think the same could be said about our faults and our mistakes. I don't mind admitting horrible things about myself and telling stories about when I behave badly. My self-esteem is intact. And so it doesn't feel sort of threatening to admit the truth in that way. So anyway, so when it comes to shame, I guess with my guests, there are so the thing I learned is I do think that there are a lot of people who are carrying around burdens that maybe they don't need to any longer. Like the weight of things they said or didn't say or did or didn't do from their past that they could have laid down a long time ago. But again, like, people don't have priests anymore. You know, like, I get we live in an increasingly secular age. I'm a fan of the Enlightenment. I'm suspicious of institutionalized religion. I get all of that. And yet at the same time, human beings have always been religious. Like, human beings fashion religion in endless variety across time, culture, place. Like, there are certain needs within the human that have always been met through what we use the category of religion to speak of these things. And so I don't know that the Enlightenment removed the human needs that were met by having things like priests. So it's one of the things I try to offer as much as I can. Like, I don't care if people intellectually assent to the same theological propositions I do. Mm-hmm. They still might need a pastor. You know, I mean, I did a conversation on stage with Lance Armstrong at the Nantucket Project, the some thought leaders gathering. And I'm like, he might be an atheist, but that guy needs a pastor, man. Mm-hmm, like, it's just so clear. I had so much compassion for the pain he felt, you know? So my friend Curlin, who's an Episcopal priest, she describes what I do as basically Nadia is sneaking into the cathedral, looking around for the most beautiful, valuable things in there, hauling them into the front yard and slapping a free sign on them.
It's great. Because, you know, so, I feel like I've also seen a dynamic that may be the opposite of what you're describing. I'm not sure, where people seem consumed with some act that, you know, as they finally confess, I think, that's not so bad, you know?
Oh, girl, I took people's private confessions in my congregation. Like, people would avail themselves of private confession and absolution. And honestly, it was so much more boring than you would think.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be like, is that it? You're done? Like, nothing personal, but I'm super unimpressed by your sin.
You know, and sometimes they're weeping and I think, oh, please don't. You know, I mean, I don't say precisely that. I try to be more skillful than that. But,
yeah,
you know, it's just like, wow, that's a heap of something that we're piling on ourselves, you know.
How do we help free each other? I mean, I think that's a compassionate question, isn't it? I mean, yeah. How do we, if we are carrying around these stories that we really could, that we're so tethered to and don't need to be anymore, there is enough grace in the world. There's enough mercy. The divine, whatever, you know, image or language or symbol people have to speak of the divine, our divine source is grace. Mm-hmm. And love and compassion. And so when we don't have enough, there still is enough to draw upon. And hopefully our prayer practices, our spiritual practices help connect us to that, mm-hmm. to our source, you know? And so how do we free each other from these burdens?
Well, that's partly, I'm sure, what happens when you elicit someone's story and you don't look repulsed, you know, in response. No. It's like you are the presence right there in that moment.
No. I have so much compassion for it.
Yeah.
I truly do because, I mean, these are the things people are confessing to me are things like if that is the only fact you knew about them and you learned about it in 160 characters on Twitter, you'd be like, take them out like trash, mm-hmm. cancel them. Mm-hmm. And yet, to let a story like that breathe, to then ask them things like, what story were you telling yourself at the time that led you to think it was okay to take that action mm-hmm. that now you know is not true? Mm-hmm. Or did you ever have any men in your life who modeled better behavior than that up until that point? You know, like mm-hmm. to dig in and ask compassionate, curious questions and let the story breathe. Mm-hmm. is so different. And then at the end, I would listen in a contemplative way. I would listen to the recording of my conversation with them, honestly, 6 or 7 times. And then I would write a blessing for them that I would record at the end. And I have to say, each of my guests contacted me and said that they just wept when they heard it. Like, that's another thing. If we don't have priests, right? Where do we go to get a blessing? Mm-hmm. I mean, have we substituted like Instagram likes? I don't know that that's the same.
Yeah, yeah. No, because the pain is so obviously rampant. And sometimes, you know, I think about what people feel when they don't get enough likes or they don't get, you know, as many likes as somebody else or right. When they... you know, don't meet some impossible standard of perfectionism or
right.
Whatever it might be, you know, and the kind of crushing burden of mm-hmm. that. And just to hear, or not even to hear, it doesn't even have to be verbal, just to see somebody not run away, you know, in hearing that story and mm-hmm. be completely present and caring.
Yeah.
And I love what you just described about asking those questions because mm-hmm. even just to step away from that behavior in one's own mind a little bit and look at it and think, you know, well, that came from pain. Look at that. Or
exactly. That's exactly right. And yeah. also, how are you a different person now? Mm-hmm. Like, can we allow for that? The performative cruelty that happens in social media, digging up something that you find that somebody said or did mm-hmm. 10 or 15 years ago, and then calling them to account, and then having this standard that there's no way for them to apologize in a perfect way for that. There's no way for them to now prove that they've changed from who they were 15 years ago. I mean, it's so cruel. And if we are people who are on some kind of spiritual path, do we not believe in human transformation?
It's definitely a difficult time in those realms because I've asked somebody that, you know, once who was talking about a friend of his and the most dismissive kind of terms and admitted that the person was now a different person. And
right.
and yet, you know, what he had done was so difficult for this person to contemplate. So I said, when you think about, maybe this goes back to an earlier point of yours, where I said, when you think about somebody going to prison, do you think about punishment or do you think about rehabilitation? Hmm. And it was clear he thinks about punishment. And I felt like, oh, well, he probably thinks that way about himself, you know?
Yeah.
In the end,
right.
You know,
that's
that.
Right.
Going back to what you said about the difference between justice and compassion.
Right. There's a beautiful verse, I think it's in Isaiah, where it says, God says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice.
Mm.
I love that.
It's beautiful.
Because part of us wants people to pay, you know?
I mean, I'm
struggling right now. My 23-year-old nephew was shot and killed 2 months ago.
I'm so sorry.
And he had a mental break, and he broke out of this detox he was in, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. banging on a door of a house thinking it was a family home. In his sort of in his mind, it was a family home, and he needed help. And he got in, and the homeowner shot and killed him. Mm-hmm. And I just got back from walking the Camino de Santiago. I walked into Santiago, having walked and prayed for 478 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And partly to kind of grieve my nephew's death. And I realized, I told maybe five people during the journey the story, and none mm-hmm. of them were for the States. And every single one was like, how long will the person be in prison? And I'm like, oh no, sorry. It's mm-hmm. totally legal here. Mm-hmm. He's considered a hero to some people, mm-hmm. probably, mm-hmm. you know, for defending himself and from a kid who just needed help. But I realized, thinking about it more, I don't wish for that person to be punished. Mm-hmm. I don't mm-hmm. think that his suffering would in any way reduce my suffering. And also, I don't know what that person's suffering is. I cannot imagine, no matter what your opinions are about firearms and the stand your ground law, I can't imagine that there is not some kind of suffering that that person is going through.
Mm-hmm.
And increasing that is not going to decrease mine. Will I ever forgive our culture? I don't know. But that's who I blame.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly, you know, I mean, that's sort of where my mind went, like, oh, you know, God, that is like an incredibly painful thing to have done, let alone, you know, caused.
Right.
But, like, too many guns, and where do we feel safe? And
yeah, I know.
It's truly terrible.
There was something affirming for me about all these people from other countries assuming it was a crime,
mm-hmm.
and being shocked when I told him it wasn't. That it was a comfort to me for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
There's also I love the Hidden Brain podcast. I'm kind of obsessed with social psychology, and Shankar Vedantam is so good. And there was a episode I've listened to twice on cold emotional states versus hot emotional states. Mm. And that social psychologists have done these studies that when you're in a hot emotional state, you're incredibly, you're very afraid, you're sexually aroused, you're, you know, mm-hmm. like some kind mm-hmm. of heightened emotional state. You cannot, from a cold emotion, a regular emotional state, reliably predict how you will act.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, if somebody is in some kind of heightened state and they act a certain way, all of us who observe it go, I would never do that.
Right.
I would never do that. Well, I have not had a young man pounding on the door of my house mm-hmm. out of his mind and break in. Like, I don't know the terror of that. My whole thing around maybe we should not have guns so readily available mm-hmm. is the fact that I cannot tell you, I wouldn't, if I had a gun, I would not shoot them.
Yeah.
I might.
Yeah.
I actually think I might.
Yeah.
So my whole thing around maybe we shouldn't have them isn't because I think I'm a better person than the people who shoot people who break into their homes.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I'm fairly certain I'm not a better person.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. I mean, we really, you know, going from all kinds of different levels, you know, people who say, I would never have chemotherapy. And you think, well, you don't know that, actually, you know, or I would never do this, or I would never do that. And it's hard to be alive. It's hard to be a human. And we do the best we can sometimes.
Oh, my gosh. That is so true. And I think, like, being able to sit in a place of compassion for, like, oh, man, it's just hard.
Yeah, it's very hard. And it's not, I mean, I have worked, you know, some amount with people who've lost children through gun violence and in school shootings and other mass shootings and with police and things like that. And, you know, what I really came to is that I felt like for some people, you know, like the parent, their job is to survive. And maybe it's someone else's job, the pastor, you know, to see where compassion can come into the situation, certainly for a while, you know.
Oh, for sure.
You know.
Oh, my gosh. No kidding. I mean, I think I would often say to my congregation, like, that faith is a team sport.
Yeah.
Like, it's not an individual competition. And, like, sometimes I'm, like, in this solid place. And, like, if you don't have faith or you can't pray, I can cover you.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but I want you to know that next week we will probably have to switch places. So, you know, if I've had somebody who was so angry at a mutual friend, and they're like, I can't. And I'm like, you know what? I can totally love that person just on your behalf for a while until you're ready, you know?
That's so great. So I know you recently, I just have to ask you this. I know you recently started meditation, and here's a quote from you. I was so desperate in 2020 that I did what I thought I would never do. I started meditating. Yeah. So was this your pandemic desperation activity? I mean, look at what we've been talking about, the suffering of others that you become intimate with and your willingness to bear the faith and express the grace that they can't even imagine exists anymore in this world. And, you know, was the pandemic so bad it drove you to meditation?
Yeah, it was humiliating. I mean, I just have always... Here's the humiliating thing about getting older. I'm 52 now, is like all the shit I said in my 20s, 30s, and 40s about, quote, who I was. Like, I'm the kind of person who, like, fill in the blank. So little of it is true now. So, and when you write memoir, you're just stuck, you know? So I now rely upon and really cherish things that I was known for making fun of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's humbling. So, the meditation thing, I'm very on and off with it. I really only do it when I'm desperate. I wish I could say I was just like, Yes. I mean, I live a very contemplative life, deeply contemplative life as a theologian. The practice of, like, sitting and doing meditation, that is, like, it's definitely a triaged kind of situation for me.
Obviously, from my point of view, you know, is an interesting choice rather than making sourdough bread or whatever people did, you know, like, in the beginning.
No, I'm like, look, if you use that time to learn how to bake bread or speak Italian or some other form of physical or improvement or something, like, good for you. I watch TV and put on 15 pounds. And then occasionally when I was desperate, I meditated. This is why I should never be seen as an example of anything except for what it looks like to be desperately in need of grace every day of my life.
Wow. But since you've had a contemplative practice for so long, I'm so interested now, you know, to hear how meditation was different than prayer.
To me, I found spaces of compassion in meditation that I did not access as deeply in prayer. Mm-hmm. I feel like there was it's more likely for my ego to go offline a little more, just mm-hmm. one inch more with meditation than with prayer. And I have cried when I was meditating mm-hmm. before. Like, suddenly it breaks something. I mean, my ego wants to just hold on to so many things. And when I feel something slipping away slightly, it can rupture something in me that needs to be ruptured, you know. So mm-hmm. that has definitely happened. I definitely felt there are feelings in meditation for me of it. I don't know a way to say it other than the cheesy, like my consciousness expanding. Mm-hmm. And I felt that walking the Camino every day, because you're walking 6 to 8 hours, and I did it as alone as I possibly could, and in these beautiful open vistas, and I felt my spirit and my consciousness unfurl into those vistas in a way that felt familiar because I'd experienced it a little bit in meditation. Wow. And I would be blissed out, man. I would take these little videos to show Eric of like what I was seeing, like 360 degree view of these just gorgeous, gorgeous settings I was in. And I listened to them. Like, I've been clean and sober for 29 years, but I watch these 30-second videos. I sound stoned out of my mind. I'm like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. I'm so grateful. I can't believe I get to do this. Oh my God, you know. But it was familiar because I had experienced a touch of it in meditation.
That's beautiful. So you were interviewed recently by Dax Shepard for the Armchair Expert podcast, and you brought up an interesting point about the ability to distinguish between fact and truth.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you mean by that.
Well, I think the Enlightenment affected us in ways that we aren't totally aware of. Mm-hmm. And so when basically humanity came to this place where we're like, we have elevated human reason. We are no longer just we aren't just superstitious beings who mm-hmm. believe things that are unprovable. We have the scientific method now. So there's a way to have things that are verifiable fact, and that's what we know is true or not true. Mm-hmm. But there are things, as you know, anybody who has a spiritual practice of some kind, we know that there are things that are true that you can't prove in a lab, mm-hmm. you know, but you know it in right. your body, and or things you experience that are not replicatable, you know, mm-hmm. or explainable in a rational way. And so my example is when people are like, do you think Jesus was actually born of a virgin? Do you think it's a fact that Mary was like a medical virgin? I'm like, well, is it a fact? That's mm-hmm. unknowable. Is it true? Yeah, I think it's true. There's something mm-hmm. true about the story. Mm-hmm. And this is why myths and sacred stories are so important for us to understand certain aspects of what it means to be human in a way that science isn't going to tell us. And having said that, I don't see them as being opposed to each other. Mm-hmm. I think they are two aspects of the glory of this creation that we get to live in the glory of being human beings. Some things we can understand scientifically, some things we can only understand spiritually or experientially. And they all should be considered valid and not a threat to each other.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And now, finally, let's talk about your most recent project, The Chapel, which looks like a new imagining of community. And how did this come about? And what about community in our time, in our crazy time?
Yeah. The impetus for starting the chapel was really, it is an experiment and it's just a pop-up thing. We're just doing it for 1 year. But it is because I wanted to have a space where people could have really beautiful, open, charitable conversations about spirituality and theology and religion. And there's not a lot of space online for that. And so I wanted it to be a place that was not ruled by ads or algorithms, which I think might be destroying humanity. Mm-hmm. And so it's subscription-based, but also offered to anybody for free who wants it. So everything we send out about it lets people know, just email us and you can be part of this for free. But I wanted to pay everybody who contributes to it. So there is a subscription fee. And it's made me realize I think it is a small percentage of people who ruin the internet. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, most people aren't horrible. And so what I realized is that if human beings have some kind of guidelines for how to be with each other, some kind of covenant for how to be with each other, things tend to go a lot better. Now, you can't end up thinking the covenant and the rules and the guidelines are more important than people. That's mm-hmm. what, mm-hmm. that's where we get tripped up often with religion. But so we have the commandments in the chapel. And the first commandment is thou shalt not be an asshole. And then another commandment is like, assign positive intent to what other people write. And you know, don't mm-hmm. comment on someone's post just to prove that you're better than them or have a better understanding of something, you know, mm-hmm. like, or no trauma dumping. Like, they're just some guidelines, you know, and there's been one person that we've had to ask to leave. That's mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And at the end, it's like, if we find that you're unable to abide by these commandments, you will be escorted out and offered a blessing and a refund. Mm. So, but only one person. So I think that's one of the things that makes the internet awful, is there's no covenant with how to be with each other.
Beautiful. So may it sustain many, many beings in our time of trying to find one another, you know, and yeah. not be so yeah. alone. It's been yeah. just so wonderful to talk to you. I wish it could go on for a lot longer, but it can't for this time. So maybe another time it would be just lovely just to keep talking and get to know one another and someday to be together.
I would love that. This has just been dreamy. I'm so glad it happened.
Thank you. And thank Catherine. And thank you all for joining us today. To learn more about Nadia's work, you can visit www.nadiablzweber.com. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, and may you live with ease.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.